have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
This is Boston Public Radio, and this is the Christmas Eve edition of Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Food writer Corby Kummer joins us in Studio 3. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he has published his list of the best cookbooks of the year. Among the titles he cites, two of them as IT cookbooks. Corby, welcome back.
Hi there. And you know, I think everybody should be able to see you when that theme music comes on.
I love to dance. You haven't seen my Santa slippers. I'll show
them
off later.
You danced in studio.
Yes, of course. All right, let's get to the business at hand. What's your criteria for an IT cookbook?
So it's something that is the way you want to cook, and it's somehow channeling your secret desires and getting in. All the influences, you've been drawn to at restaurants, you've kind of thought, gee, I want to try that one of these days. And then suddenly there it is, all in a book. So everybody starts emailing me about a couple of books. And indeed, I see why. So the one that I call the ittier of the two IT cookbooks, that's my word of the year, is called Jerusalem. And it's by Yotam Ottolenghi. So this is a guy who opened six now restaurants in London, not Israel. He grew up in Israel, in Jerusalem. And it's a great backstory with his co-author, Sami Tamimi, who is Palestinian, raised Muslim in East Jerusalem. And they have collaborated. They didn't know each other as children. They met and found out in England and found out they had this incredibly parallel history. They're the same age. They grew up at the same time. Similar but different influences. So what it is it's Mediterranean food. It's served in Jerusalem. It's sort of filtered by way of a very sophisticated international filter in London. And it has everything we want. It's North African. It's Moroccan. It's Turkish. It's Italian. Part of Ottolenghi's family is Italian. So it's got all these great dishes you just want to go straight in and try. And what my friends are telling me is they all work. That is such a rare criterion in a cookbook.
Really? That's sad to know, but okay.
Oh, Callie, must fall from your eyes.
Oh, yeah, I'm very sad about that, okay. But yes, this book, this IT book that you called the ittier of the two, Jerusalem, I just went online because I was kind of curious about how one, as yourself, comes up with the book list for yourself. So Palette Press has pulled together a list, which I thought was great. They call it a big meta list. So they looked at all the lists. So they looked at your list and everybody else's list and then added up how many books ended up on the list.
So you are so good. I went and I looked at a bunch of them and thought, what is their criteria? Well, they don't know what they're doing. Okay, let's hear.
Well, the Jerusalem, to your point about its being ittier, is first placed on 12 lists.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I hate following
trends. This is a big deal, just so people know. And a lot of it, not a lot of it, but some of it has to do with the fact that this Yotam has a column in The Guardian, so he has a following.
Very well followed, and it's vegetarian. And it's sort of, to writers like us who are mostly on the web, it's very comforting that somebody can develop an international following just by being on the web.
And the cover of this book looks beautiful.
Yeah, it is gorgeous. And he's got a follow-up with his name, Ottolenghi. It came out at least 2 years before Jerusalem, but it hasn't come out in this country. It'll be published next spring.
All right, so the other IT cookbook, less itty, ittier, but is Gran Cocina Latina.
Yeah, this is, I think, one of those books of every couple of years that is this masterly, scholarly, encyclopedic volume of all the foods of Latin America. There's a wonderful woman named Maricel Precia who has since become, when I say since, she started work on this book about 17 years ago. Mm. This has been a long time in the making. She grew up in Cuba. She got a PhD in medieval history at NYU, New York University, where she taught for a while. Then she changed to food, which was a first love of hers, and has started a cacao business on the side. Oh. I first met her when she invited me to go on a trip to Ecuador to look at chocolate plantations for El Rey. That was a fabulous trip, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
But it was just one of many, many trips she makes to Latin America. So there's lots of Mexican food in this, but everybody knows Mexican food. You can find Rick Bayless's book, Diana Kennedy. There's other books. What there isn't is Venezuela, Ecuador, Paraguay, Uruguay, places you've only read about and you have no idea how the influences intermesh. She's got it all in this book. But as scholarly as it is, it's very cook-friendly. It is organized by dishes, by families of food. So if you're thinking of making a first course or you want a starch or you want a roast meat, it's organized by those. It's very interestingly organized.
I like the fact that even in the title, she lets you know that she's using the grand concept, a holistic concept of Latino, Latina, to pull together all of the ethnic influences, as you've just mentioned. So that makes it very interesting. And you point out in your column that this book is one that will be attractive to people because they're eating this food a lot in restaurants. We're drawn to it now.
And so, here we are. We're next door to Alston and Cambridge, which both have big Brazilian populations, so there's lots of Brazilian food. So we in Boston might know Brazilian, or we might even know Cape Verdean food. This will show a lot of the roots and the influences of the Portuguese and Brazilian food that traveled to Cape Verde. It's just got a lot of fascinating threads in it.
According to Palette Press, it's on five lists as a big book to pay attention to.
And it should have been on everybody's list. So I'm really glad that I got to put it on mine.
All right. Martinist Cuisine at Home. Tell us about that book.
All right. So you guys have already had Nathan Mervold in the studio, and I'm showing you a big color leaflet with these sexy pictures of pots cut in half. So literally, they cut ovens in half, they cut pots in half. So when they're cooking things in it, you can see these, you know, really sexy pictures of what it looks like inside the oven, inside the pot. Last year, they came out with a 6-volume encyclopedia called Modernist Cuisine, that I consider the must-have book of the past, even 20 years, along with Harold McGee's On Food and Cooking. This is it because it's a model on the Old Time Life series. So every spread, I'm showing you a spread now that has half of a blender cut in half.
That.
So instead of some high-tech, you can't afford it tool like in the first 6-volume set, Modernist Cuisine at Home uses blender and pressure cooker and things that are generally more accessible.
Loving it. Yeah, that makes sense. It's on three lists, if you want to know,
okay.
From Palette Press. So that brings me to a question. Some of the people, now you just spoke about how you had followed the author of the other book, Gran Cucina Latina, so you know her work and you've been waiting for her to come out with the final product. But since these people, modernist cuisine people, got a lot of attention last year, does that set them up to be in position to be one on the best cookbook lists again?
That's a very good question. And I don't know. I think that the diehards and hardcore people like me who love all of the learning opportunities, like about food sanitation, about microbiology, things that I've never seen collected or made so comprehensible. There were 40 people working on that 6-volume set for at least 2 years, and they made it just as clear as they could. They were like very experienced magazine editors and encyclopedia. It's beautifully laid out and comprehensible. So is this new book. Now, everybody laughed at Nathan Mervold, who is a zillionaire from Microsoft. He made millions and millions, probably billions, at Microsoft, and they thought this was just this eccentric project he could waste money on. What was he doing publishing a $550 book? It's now $569 on Amazon, which is similar to what it was last year. Nobody would buy it, you know. And why was it hardcover? Why wasn't it an app? And indeed, people like books. It has been an international bestseller. It has way made more than his investment, he says. Nobody ever thought that it would. It certainly has grossed millions of dollars already. So does it set this book up to be? I don't know how this book will do. It's $120 as opposed to $560. It's one volume instead of six. I think it's got a lot of recipes that are interesting to use. I'd still rather have the full 6 volumes, but that's many hundreds of dollars more. So we'll see how it does. But considering that last year was essentially a runaway bestseller that no one thought would sell, I bet this will do well too.
I am speaking with Corby Comer. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he has published his list of the best cookbooks of the year. And we are talking about them as we march through the list. We just finished talking about Modernist Cuisine, which is $120. By the way, the Jerusalem book looks pretty big. How expensive is that?
Oh, I think it's only about $35 or $40, and it's in 10 speed. It's not expensive.
All right. And you brought up an interesting point, and that is, why do people continue to buy cookbooks when the Epicuriouses and the Food Networks, so many people are now trained to download for dinner, if you will, and, you know, and they are actually able to keep a recipe file online. So what draws you to purchase a cookbook at this point?
Well, for me, it's the scholarly research of a woman who spends years going all over Latin America, a team of 40 people who get to be in a lab and draw on all kinds of scientific knowledge that nobody else has, or that they really, they're incredibly tech savvy, of course, that they uniquely can draw together. So I want to be able to read it. Or, for example, the next book on the list is called Burma Rivers of Flavor. There I can read about a Southeast Asian cuisine that's very similar to Thai and Singaporean, but it's got some important differences by a wonderful writer, Naomi Duguid, with just gorgeous pictures. So I like the experience of just reading it. I think people still do like reading. But online, yes, lots of my friends go on and they download for dinner. I like that expression. But it's not the same as thinking, I want chicken tonight. What can I make with chicken? That's different from Jerusalem. This is full of recipes I never would have thought of. Maybe I'll go out and buy molasses syrup or pomegranate syrup or Aleppo chili, things that I haven't started stocking yet. And I see a bunch of recipes that appeal to me. Until you see that context, it's like, why read a paper magazine or newspaper? And I think the answer is going to become increasingly, gee, I don't know why. But one reason is you discover lots of things you never would have thought of otherwise that you will remember. They'll stick in your mind. And you'll think, I want to try that in a couple of weeks.
As far as I can tell, it's not on Palette Press's any list. They only did books that had more than a few lists. So that was interesting to me. The next one you have, From a Polish Country House Kitchen, 90 recipes, not 100, which I think it's funny, for the ultimate comfort food.
So I bet that was on nobody's list. I mean, you can be a surprise at the end. But the author is Anne Applebaum, and she is a journalist. She wrote a book about gulags called Gulag: A History that won a Pulitzer. She's a journalist. She married into a family that had Polish forebears. Who knows much about Eastern European food? Like, not many people. I have Hungarian and Czech antecedents in my forebears in my family. I wanted to know more about it. She wanted to be able to explore the difference between Jewish and non-Jewish food. It's a really interesting distinction because the populations were so intermingled. But when you go to Eastern Europe now, what you find is that everything is pork and what they call schmaltz. American and Ashkenaz Jews say schmaltz is chicken fat. Schmaltz in Eastern Europe means lard. It's their cooking fat. It's their animal fat. It's their medium. Nonetheless, the recipes are immensely similar. It's just some use pork and non-kosher products and some use kosher products. And she explores these similarities. But more than that, there are foods that just look good. And what we like to forget is that we are in a northern climate where not that much grows. We're so used to be able to get all the Mediterranean ingredients in Ottolenghi's books in Jerusalem whenever we want to go to the market. But it's not what grows here. What grows here is very similar to Eastern Europe. So it's yogurt and cucumber and sour cream dishes. And she's got lots of flavored vodkas. So for the home brewer in you, you can discover your home brewer and do essences of vodkas, which can be your next year's holiday gift. You can do it at the end of January, which Robin was saying is a dead month for everybody. So there's lots of comfort foods. And then there's this roast chicken stuff with breadcrumbs. And the breadcrumbs melt into the chicken fat and the juice at the end. And I thought, why have I never tried that? Of course that's going to make this delicious, wet kind of stuffing slash sauce. So I can't wait to have it.
Oh, well, sounds wonderful. And anything that has comfort food in it would attract me. So do you have to be a person that is really into cookbooks? I know, you know, you told me what attracts you to a cookbook. I'm trying to figure out why the rest of us buy it. And I have a question for you about a cookbook that is not on your list that seems to be on a number of...
Which I might have read, might not have, but go ahead.
The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook.
Oh, you know, I knew you were going to mention that.
Yeah, of course I have to.
Okay,
I was about
to mention the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook when we were talking about downloading for dinner and the idea that lots of people know Ottolenghi because of his Guardian column.
Right.
for which he's paid something by The Guardian, brought him international celebrity. That's great. It's the quality that outed. So the woman who writes Smitten Kitchen is an even better and for young entrepreneurs, more inspiring story because she decided she was going to write what she was cooking at home. It started out, it's this great story, as My Bad Date Diary and going to restaurants. And then she decided, no, I think that, you know, when I'm coming home and cooking myself comfort food after the bad dates, why don't I just talk about my own cooking experiments? She has struck a nerve, I think probably with a lot of women who've gone out on bad dates. But more than that, she's in a small urban kitchen. She loves food. She kind of dreams of it during the day. It's very much the phenomenon that made Julie and Julia that
exactly.
woman.
Mm-hmm.
She had a dull job. She was escaping. She did it by cooking Julia Child. The woman who writes Smitten Kitchen, whose name is escaping me.
Deb Perlman.
Mm-hmm. She was instead going to lots of different online sources and lots of cookbooks and deciding, how can I make this taste even better to myself in my small urban kitchen? That's a potent and appealing combination for a lot of single and young married cooks.
But it didn't make your list.
That's a great demographic. No, because it's charming, but it doesn't show me anything I don't have in a million other cookbooks. Mm. So it's not going to, I won't learn anything from it, but it's usable recipes. And I think that what is selling that book is the voice. Mm. And it's great that a voice can be persuasive enough to sell books. So I'm all in favor of it. A, establishing your own business on the internet and making lots of money. Great. And B, having this warm, experimenting, you are in the kitchen with me voice. That's terrific, too, that it's won over so many readers.
All right. Well, it's interesting because I think people who buy cookbooks are sort of like those of us women who buy a lot of purses. You know, you don't really need another one, but you just keep buying them because there's maybe one, two things in there. So I'm not buying it necessarily for all of the history that you're looking for. I like the pictures. I maybe one or two recipes, and then I end up, I have a million cookbooks.
So it's so interesting that a lot, I hate to think that I'm swayed by pictures. So many of the books I put on this list have gorgeous pictures
yes,
in them.
They do. They're fabulous.
And that's something that even though web, and you can have the most beautiful iPad screen with a Retina resolution, it isn't the same as being able to thumb through a book. I brought in the huge oversized color leaflet for Modernist Cuisine. It's the pictures, the enormous oversized cool pictures that help sell that. Burma Rivers of Flavor, Naomi's pictures are absolutely gorgeous to look at. The one really educational book that I put on the list for me is, Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast by Ken Forkish. I love bread. I love baking bread. This has got a lot of instructional pictures in it. But most of the others are just beautiful color pictures. And to your point, there's one or two things. The writer Barbara Kafka, whom I love both as a friend and a writer and an inspiration, says that people buy books for one recipe. So, for example, the Polish thing, it's going to be that breadcrumb stuffed chicken. And all of your readers and listeners are going to find one recipe from each of these books.
All right. Well, thank you for letting us know about them anyway. Because your expertise is very much appreciated.
Thank you, Kelly.
Well, thank you, Corby Conner.
All right. Happy cooking.
This is Boston Public Radio, and I'm Callie Crossley. And we are coming up to talk with our wine guru, Jonathan Alsop, about what's the best affordable, accessible holiday gift that you can buy at the last minute. You know it's wine. We'll be bringing you that story next on Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.